You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You
are. Okay, we're going. We're on section 96 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger, so let's start reading.
Okay. 96. The Inceptual Interpretation of Beings as Physis, which is Greek word for physics.
Yeah, our nature, yeah.
The meagerness of our capacity for genuine thought is evident in the fact that we no longer appreciate the uniqueness of this projection of beings as physis. Instead, we pass it off as something most obvious, since what immediately confronts human thinking is, of course, quote, nature. To say nothing of the fact that it at issue here is not at all, quote, nature, neither as object of natural science, nor as landscape, nor as sensibility. How are we to grasp correctly what is alien and unique in this projection? In the open realm of physis, why did logos, as well as Greek word for mind, have to be named very early as foundational sites of, quote, being, and why did all knowledge have to be instituted according to them? The oldest transmitted saying about beings, the aphorism of Anaximander.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. Do you have anything to say about this passage?
No.
So somebody says that we have this incapacity for genuine thought, which he's talked about before. And that is most evident, he says, or actually just evident, in that we no longer appreciate the uniqueness of this projection of beings as nature, I guess. We might as well say. Mm-hmm. Instead, we pass it off as something most obvious, since what immediately confronts human thinking is, of course, nature. So I think we have this word, this phrase, projection of beings, the uniqueness of this projection of beings. The inceptual interpretation of beings. So I think what he's getting at is that somehow we have forgotten or lost, in a sense, the sense of the magic or the uniqueness of the fact that beings are. I guess a part of nature. I mean, but I think what do we mean by nature? And that's why he goes on to say we don't mean sort of the object of natural science, nor landscape, meaning like, you know, hills and fields, nor as sensibility, which I would say what he means by that is you know, someone's nature, like their personality or their innate inclinations and sensibilities. And in the open realm of nature, why did logos and mind have to be named as the foundational sites of being, and why did all knowledge have to be instituted according to them? And then he finishes the oldest transmitted saying about beings, the aphorism of Anaximander. Anaximander is the Greek philosopher who came up with the idea of the apeiron, or the apeiron, which is the boundless, the infinite, the unbounded, which to Anaximander is the is essentially the locus of being. Being lies in the apeiron, and everything comes from and returns to the apeiron, which I think is really what he's kind of getting at here, is that nature is, as Anaximander would say, the unbounded, or the boundless, or the infinite. It's not solely what we might think of as smaller fragments or smaller figments or little realms of nature, such as what natural science calls nature, or the green and the lush and the or our inner sensibilities. It's something much bigger, and yet we've reduced it, beings. And the nature that they are projected out of, down to logos and mind, or thinking and mind, or speech and mind, or speech and thought. And there's something much more vast, something much larger and unbounded going on. That's why I think he finishes with Anaximander there at the end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think he's just kind of saying, you know, our sense of beings, what beings are, it has become very, very limited. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of like an early hippie here, right? He's like, you got to get in touch with the universe, right? Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Now we've got some Greek words here.
Yeah.
So we have physis again.
Yeah.
And then we have logos. And then we have.
Is that techne? What is that? The title of it.
Yeah, the title. I think that is techne.
And did we decide what that actually means?
Art.
What?
Art, or.
Oh, so it's not technology?
Well, it's techne. It's the human arts. In a sense, okay. Human practice, human action. Okay. I'm not sure what this second Greek word is, but I think we can get by without it.
97, physis techne. So overpowering is physis that Greek word and Greek word.
That second one is logos.
For logos are experienced as belonging intrinsically to it, and even to beings in their beingness, which is not yet grasped as the general, in the manner of an idea. Yet no sooner does experience as original knowledge of beings themselves develop into a questioning of them than the questioning itself, by withdrawing from beings, must distinguish itself from them and be grasped in a certain sense as autonomous, and even by placing itself before beings as producing them. At the same time, however, as a questioning, it must seize upon a certain viewpoint, one which can be taken only from what is interrogated itself. Yet how is that possible if beings as such are the first and the last? And what if constancy and presencing as emergence, Greek word for truth, are experienced and established as self-emergence, over and against questioning and independent of questioning, and thus not as is questioning and an accosting of beings, and thereby not a proficiency in them in their beingness, i.e. not a the techne. Since physis is not techne, but indeed what first allows techne to be experienced and seen as such, therefore, the more questioning the question becomes, i.e. the more it brings itself before beings as beings, and thus interrogates beingness and entrenches itself in the formula.
Yeah, this is
I think I just saw that as something like, what are beings?
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we look that up?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, it's what are beings.
Yeah, and I think that's like an Aristotelian question. Yeah, go ahead.
The more techne must then precisely come to count as what determines the viewpoint. Physis is not techne, which now means that what pertains to techne, namely the skilled gaze in advance at the Greek word for look,
Eidos,
the representing and bringing before oneself of the look, precisely all this occurs of its own accord in physis, in Greek words.
Being is the eidos, idea as emergent, as stepping forth, yet as offering a view of itself. Yeah. That's eidos and idea.
Right.
Usha is being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. That Plato can interpret the beingness of beings as idea implies not only an experience of... What's that? I think being... No.
It is. I don't know.
Okay, an experience of Ove as physis, but also the development of the question under the guideline of techne, such that techne is the counter attitude to physis, and at the same time is compelled by physis. Techne then indeed, and especially in Aristotle, offers the anticipatory grasp for the interpretation of beingness as the Greek word for junction of two more beautiful Greek words.
Form. The first one is form. And the second one is matter. Form and matter.
Form and matter. Thereby is posited that distinction, form content, which incipiently and in the sense of the dominant guiding question prevails in all metaphysical thinking. It does so most strongly and surely, but at the same time most inflexibly in Hegel. Okay.
Okay, so I was just... what? First of all, can we just skip this section?
Yes. I mean, I feel like there's something in there, but it's...
There is. Let's unravel it.
Yeah.
So overpowering is physis that logos... We'll ignore that other word. Logos is experience as belonging intrinsically to it and even to beings in their beingness. So overpowering, yeah. So physis is overpowering. I think meaning it has this sense of being the thing that everything is a part of, nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is not nature. Nature is all there is. All is nature. So it's an odd word because what is it then, right? Is it just mean all of existence, or all of being, or all that there is, or nature, like physis nature? Is it just the physical world? I mean, that could be, in a sense, you know, what it has come to imply. Like, so metaphysics is metaphysis, but yet, you know, obviously nature is a word that means a lot more than just the physical stuff. It's just got so many meanings. So he's saying, so overpowering is it that logos sort of belongs intrinsically to it, and even to beings in their beingness, which is not yet grasped as the general in the manner of an idea. So, yeah, I mean, again, idea, very Platonic phrase, meaning the beingness of beings. And I'm not sure what he means by not yet grasped as the general. He might be just hearkening back to sort of the mindset that is the Greeks were in or something, but I think that we can move that on. We can move beyond. Yet no sooner does experience as original knowledge of beings themselves develop into a questioning of them, then the questioning itself, by withdrawing from beings, must distinguish itself from them and be grasped in a certain sense as autonomous and even by placing itself before beings as producing them. So all of a sudden, you know, we have nature, we have logos. Logos is a part of nature. It's experienced as belonging to nature, and logos belongs to beings in their beingness. So logos participates in the essence of beings, and can grasp beings in the kind of in their abstract, essential, general aspect. Logos has that ability, which is interesting. And yet we have this thing called experience, where we have an original knowledge of beings themselves, and sort of that also participates in nature or has an experience of nature and is mediated by logos. And as experience develops into a questioning of beings and starts asking about beings, it then starts to question itself by withdrawing from beings and distinguishes itself from them, and it becomes grasped in a certain sense as autonomous by placing itself before beings as producing them. So out of this sort of natural milieu where everything is kind of blended together, experience all of a sudden steps out and away from nature and away from beings and becomes a kind of self-analyzing, self-questioning thing that seeks autonomy and evenness or paralysis and stasis and removedness. And it steps away from beings and becomes almost a predecessor of beings and begins to produce them. So this is this real kind of truncation in the human experience. The same time, however, as a questioning, it must seize upon a certain... So as experience starts to question, it seizes upon a certain viewpoint, one which can be taken only from what is interrogated itself. So it then starts to assess, it's to create a viewpoint or a worldview. A worldview that emerges from what is being interrogated, and what it's questioning is itself. So the worldview develops out of self-questioning. Yet how is that possible if beings as such are the first and the last? So how has experience stepped out of beings, stepped away from beings, and become a kind of purveyor or viewpoint of beings to precede them and to produce them? But how is that possible if everything is a being? And what if constancy and presencing, and those are, again, time terms, that time is a constant and time is always present, what if constancy and presencing, or the emergence of things...
Yeah, truth.
Truth.
This emergence, truth.
What if they are experienced and established as self-emergence over and against questioning and independent of questioning, and thus not, as is questioning, an accosting of beings, and thereby not a proficiency in them, in their beingness, not a techne? So what if constancy and presencing are experienced as self-emergence? So what if the facets of time vis-a-vis experience are just seen as kind of emerging of themselves? They just kind of, in a sense, magically appear. And they appear and they present themselves to questioning, and yet they're independent of this questioning. They're separate from this questioning. And therefore, this experience does not become a kind of relationship with beings or a proficiency of beings in their beingness, i.e. not a techne. So in a sense, experience or awareness of beings or awareness of constancy and presencing loses its connection to beings and its proficiency in them and its techne aspect, which is stands apart from nature, as things just kind of self-emerge. Since physis is not techne, but indeed what first allows techne to be experienced, so physis allows techne to be experienced, so nature allows the human praxis to be experienced and seen as such. Therefore, the more questioning the question becomes, i.e. the more it brings itself before beings as beings and thus interrogates beingness and entrenches itself in the formula what is being. So as this questioning becomes entrenched in the question of beings, the more techne must then precisely come to count as what determines the viewpoint. So as we gain this viewpoint, techne determines more and more that viewpoint because we have stepped out of nature and are now in a self-referencing, self-questioning state where techne becomes, in a sense, in a second nature. Physis is not techne, nature is not technology, which now means that what pertains to techne, meaning the skilled gaze in advance at the eidos, so techne becomes a skilled way of looking at the forms of the ideas, the representing and bringing before oneself of the look, precisely all that occurs of its own accord in physis. In a sense, what I think what he's saying is that the viewpoint or the experience or the logos or the becomes a representing and a skilled gaze and steps out of nature and becomes a self-referencing, self-emerging, self-questioning, in a sense, separate, closed system of meaning, logos, eidos. And usha is the eidos, so being becomes the idea as stepping forth, yet as offering a view of itself. Yeah. So I think we're hearing here a kind of very, very minute and particular analysis of how experience comes to separate us from nature, how a dependence on self-emergence, self-questioning, self-reference, self-representing becomes a techne against, over and against a physis, and how we lose touch with beings and we start to engage in the eidos and the look and the form and the beingness of beings, and we start to, in a way, exist outside of beings and view our viewpoint as that which creates beings, and this is the abandonment by being. This is kind of a Greek-oriented breakdown of how that state of mind emerged. I think it's really important to notice eidos, which again is that eidos and idea. These are the legendary forms of Plato. And I've read this before Stanley Rosen book. This is going to be translated as look.
Yeah.
So instead of form and idea, it's everything has a look. All right. Everything has a way that it appears, and that's its eidos or form. Mm. You finished this, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Plato can interpret the beingness of beings as idea. We just said that, you know, mm-hmm. that's the beingness of beings as idea implies not only an experience of, I think that's being as physis, but also the development of the question under the guideline of techne, such that techne has a counter attitude to physis and at the same time is compelled by physis. So, so Plato interprets the beingness of beings as idea. We know that. So he has an experience of being as physis, as nature, but also the development of the question under the guideline of techne. So techne is the counter attitude of I don't know, man. Techne then indeed, and especially in Aristotle, offers anticipatory grasp for the interpretation of beingness as the junction of form and matter. Yeah, I mean, he's really talking here about how we get to this idea of beingness of beings. That's the important issue. Meaning, how did we get to this state of mind where we have a sense of the essential, representable character of beings mm-hmm. that we can then think about, talk about, represent to ourselves, and have in cognitive relationship to ourselves, yet these beings, the beingness, the beings that are the beingness, mm-hmm. are in a sense fictions, mm-hmm. or they're just represented ideas that are abandoned by being. And the way we get there is that we have an experience of being as physis, mm-hmm. But the question, of being falls under the domain of techne. And techne, again, I think really needs to be thought of as like, he's really distinguishing here techne and physis. They're really like, he's pointing out that they are very kind of opposite and different worlds. That physis, I would say, in a certain sense, is the world of bang, and techne is in a certain sense the world of being. Mm-hmm. And we have leaned toward techne. We have moved into techne. We have started to take techne in a sense as physis, mm-hmm. as nature. Mm. And this has allowed us to come up with this idea of beingness as idea, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And techne then, especially in Aristotle, offers the anticipatory grasp. So we're back to that idea of mm-hmm. thought as anticipatory grasp mm-hmm. for the interpretation of beingness as where matter and form conjoin, mm-hmm. come together. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, matter and form, this distinction, is prevalent in all metaphysical thinking, he says. And you can think of matter and form, in a sense, as physis and techne,
mm.
or being beings and beingness. The form is, again, just Plato's word for the idea or the eternal, form of things, the eternal stamp. The
essence.
Right? Matter is physis. It's the thing that is sort of the substance of the world that is imprinted upon by the form.
Mm-hmm.
So this techne physis turns to forma materia, or form and content.
Mm-hmm.
And that prevails in all metaphysical thinking. Mm-hmm. It does so most strongly and surely, but at the same time, most inflexibly in Hegel. So form and content, I think we can kind of understand that dichotomy now, right? Like, that is a seriously specific and foundational distinction in the way we think about the world. And that's there because of all of this techne, physis, beingness, idea, eidos stuff that the Greeks kind of invented. They invented this format of looking at the world. And it has come to the day to the idea of form and content. The idea that there is stuff, and then that stuff is stamped by ideas, by the ideas of things, and that's how we think about the world. So, you know, I kind of feel like that's enough reading. There's a lot of ideas there. Might be interesting to see if any of the things we've been thinking about this week, like can give us maybe some real world examples of what all this really means for us. And I don't know. I thought I was intrigued by your talking about the books you were reading. I thought maybe you would talk a little about those books and what what annoyed you or enchanted you about those books, and maybe I can then like a wizard apply techne and physis to those books. I don't know. I can't think of how that applies now, but I'm hoping that maybe once you talk about the books, that something will come. So maybe maybe give
us
a little.
I think the one thing that just like specifically that I find that I wanted to mention is just this idea of self-emergence and how this seems to actually be, or like I imagine this is again self-analysis kind of therapy, trying to figure out the truth of oneself. I feel like in a way that's very on the techne side of the equation. So
definitely.
So again, it's like this sort of unexpected, given how we think these days, this idea that actually it's not maybe of value, really.
Well, let's dive more into that. But I do want to say, like, like you can even take the form content. Instead of techne and physis, let's even use form and content. Well, we can use anything. But I mean, you know, I think that the content form distinction has an interesting application in therapy, because in a sense you could call content and form you could call it history and story. You know, form therapeutic practice is that you've got all this content, meaning your life has been this massive sequence of events, right? But it doesn't have any form. So what form means is you start to give it shape, analyze it, develop stories, figure out causes, start to look for similarities, start to look for connections, right? Start to mean things, and then you start to develop meanings, and then you start to develop real theories of, you know, why and wherefore and what and who and when, and you know, and you put a form over your whole life, and all of a sudden your whole life becomes like, you know, it has shape. right? Yeah. And that's becomes, that's just story, right?
Yeah.
That's the techne that is stamped via the viewpoint onto the physis of your life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's how we operate now. Yeah. You know, that's how we think about time, continuity, and presencing, and think about the events of time. That's how we make sense of things, we call it, right?
Yeah.
But that's all obviously what Heidegger would call metaphysical thinking.
Yeah.
And it's all obviously pretty conjectural, pretty self-referential.
Yeah.
Pretty worldviewy, but this stuff he's talking about here is really is the roadmap of therapy.
This is the
epistemological underpinnings of the therapeutic adventure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, should I talk about the books a little?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are two books I've been reading in the last couple of days. One was recommended by a friend. It's called, I believe, Mother Code. And I was... I read the sample and I liked it, so I kept reading it, which is sort of unusual for me to read sort of a popular fiction book or nonfiction book. And it just it very quickly started to remind me of all the tropes and stories that I've been brought up with and all the ways that we're supposed to think about life, I guess, in all really a negative way overall.
What would you say in general, what would the book say it's about? It's called Mother Code, but what
is
it?
Yeah, so it's about a woman who basically decides she doesn't want to have children, but then decides last minute she does want to have a child. And goes through a divorce and then is trying to find somebody who will have a child with her at age, she's 39, I guess.
Is a fiction book or?
No, it's a nonfiction. It's based on her.
So it's her story of becoming a mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so she talks about her mother and her grandmother and there's just, and all the, bad things and, mental health problems that they had, and she has a very big fear of passing it on to her child, is what she says, or kind of reliving it. And also, it's just everything bad you could imagine happening, she manages to mention, I guess, is sort of how it
because
how
it happened
it feels.
To her, or she's worried about it happening.
A mix of both, yeah. I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, suicide prominently features in the narrative, which is always for me a little jarring because it's so.
She disturbing. Thinks about killing herself?
No, she doesn't. It's apparently her mom and her grandma,
right?
And then some guy she was dating,
right? So it sounds to me like a kind of a memoir or a. It's a memoir
of
all the really hard parts about mothering.
Yeah.
Right? And
totally.
How hard it is and all the
yes.
bad.
Oh, and then she does get, I'm only a third of the way through.
All the bad stuff she was handed, the tough decks, the tough hands.
The fear of her kid having genetic disorders because her half-brother has some really bad ones.
So it's kind of like, I'm a neurotic mess, but I want to be a mother kind of book.
Yeah, and then it gets into, it gets quite into
What's the point of the book? Is there any point?
I don't know. I mean, again, I'm only a third of the way through, so I don't know. But it gets it gets into the whole patriarchy. Women are, it's all the messages that women get about how you can't both have a fulfilling life and have your work life happening and have a child, and how she believed that, but then she questioned that, and how that message comes from the patriarchy and white society and stuff. And so she really gets into that kind of stuff too.
You read the summary of this book and
That's the thing. That's the thing. It was a total surprise. Both those things that I just mentioned were like a surprise, like a third of the way in. I was like, wait, this is not what I signed up for. So I don't know. But I think the overall, the main thing for me is it's reminding me of all the things I grew up with. I mean, all the like stories.
Yeah. It sounds like she lives in Olympia.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's like all the stories that you hear from people. I don't know. All the like tragic stories of how hard
everything is. Oh, it sounds like both tragic stories and also like stupid theories.
Yeah.
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 Like, what a waste of time. People just spend so much time thinking about the stupidest things. Like, just like these theories of like how society is ordered and what society tells us and how cruel society is and how all these like historical forms that are oppressing us. And what a pathetic, passive way to live and think, you know? Right? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Also, it sounds like a lot of these things, it's just like, you know, suicide and genetic disorders and all this stuff. It's just like, it just sounds like a long litany of like all the horrible things we're supposed to be afraid of.
Yes, totally. Oh, yeah. And that was.
Which, how hard is
and
it?
And like, she just mentions like these different books. I mentioned this one to you. And like, one of them was like about this family who has their fifth child, and that fifth child, and they had like the perfect life. And then that fifth child like tears apart the family and is terrible. And, you know,
so I want to say again, what's the point?
I mean, I think the point.
Is she really trying to teach
and what
us
my friend
or
said,
is she just trying to unload her neurotic shit?
I mean, what my friend said,
and
is
just make sure you have the same neurotic shit she does.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
what did your friend say the point of the book is?
To like
it's such
open,
a relatable journey
to open people's minds about the about stuff of mothering or something, or like the different dynamics.
Yeah, so that's a really good example, because it's just like, you know.
And I just want to say that like I so realized that that's like everything I grew up in. Those kinds of messaging is just like so.
You say grew up in? You're saying like your mom and dad, or you're just
yeah, just like the books I read, the stuff I believed. Uh-huh. Like I just feel like you know the school I went to, the kind of stuff we were taught was like fact. You know, it's just like, it feels like, just really reminded me that I was really trained this way.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like really depressing.
Yeah.
It's a really negative.
Decayed,
oppressive.
Yeah.
I'm impressed by the passivity of it, because it's just this, the more you talk about how, you know, the world has all these events and all these opinions and all these systems, the systemicness of life, the smaller you become, the less capable you become of doing anything on your own. And the more the world is just a crushing garbage smasher that you're just ground up in, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
what are we gonna say?
That's form and content there, isn't it? I mean, that's just like, so the world is the world, and it's just doing all these things, right? And then you go and you're like, I'm going to write a book, because you're like a loser grump. And so you're like, I'm going to write a book about mothering. And so then you've got to choose what you're going to put in that book, right? And because you're a neurotic, depressed douche woman, as a douche of woman, can a douche be a woman? You know, you're just a neurotic, depressed, no good, nothing. That's what I would say she is. Obviously, because, you know, it's like, what did she choose? Like it's obvious that you can depict mothering either as literally a torture chamber that run by the powers that be, or as a celestial, you know, gorgeous, beautiful journey. Like, those are the kind of the two axes, right? But there's also all this other stuff and other possibilities. I mean, the possibilities are endless in a way. But you just have this now, this like narrative obsession with the grueling and the gross and the dumb and the vicious, right? And that's just like what's very hip. And that's the form on the content, right? That's techne on the physis, right? Yeah. I mean, it's the story you want to live and tell yourself, you know? And I love the whole thing, like, you know, what people, you know, society tells us that that kind of shit. Any book that like talks that way,
is literally written by an idiot, written by like a sub intellect. Yeah.
Right? Society tells us. I mean, the patriarchy tells us, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, the institutions. It's just like nobody, everybody is talking. there's things being told in every direction of every kind. Like, people have such an ability now to have this like selective perception of what is going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that as just like objective fact. They take mm-hmm. their narrow selective perception, which is usually just a morbid, depressed, kind of loserish way of thinking about things.
Mm-hmm.
And they just take that and then they call that objective fact. Like it's mm-hmm. systemic this and this and this, you know. But it's nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. It's just simply a viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stamping the form on the content, and this is being abandoned by being, because mm-hmm. all of this stuff is put forward as like objective truth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, she thinks this is objective truth. Everything in this book is objective truth, but of course it's not. It's just her little story.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, sounds awful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like the way that probably everything is presented as objective truth, but it is actually a story. Like that also really struck me about it. A friend of mine is including me/us, I guess, in this pitch for an IVF documentary. And
wait, me?
You're not in it, actually.
Oh, you mean us, me. You and her?
No, there's a bunch of people in it. I'm a very small character, but I am in the deck. So our story of you getting cancer, becoming infertile, doing the thing. So I got to read our story.
First of all, I haven't made a penny. Nobody's presented a contract to me.
So the point is...
So you're talking about me in this documentary?
No, I haven't done anything. She just wrote my story up. So I looked at it. I was like, wow, my story. And of course, it's inaccurate slightly. And it kind of is like about heartstrings. And so it was interesting to see myself presented.
It's about heartstrings? What do you mean by that? Heartstrings.
It's pulling at heartstrings.
Oh, it pulled. I thought you said it's about heartstrings.
No, it's pulling at heartstrings. It pulls at heartstrings.
Well, I hope so.
So all stories are like that, whether it's supposedly a fiction or a nonfiction. And
there's,
I think...
there's no such thing as nonfiction.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just think for me... I don't know, the challenge is to somehow kind of grow up from it, which is not as easy as I would like.
What do you mean?
I still get kind of tied into her story, and I'm like, I don't know. I still get a little tied into her story. I still get worked up about her story
You get tied into it, or she says things that are like gross
triggering.
And scary and trigger you.
I mean, yeah, that's probably more likely, yes.
I mean, you don't like people talking about violence. You don't like people talking about suicide. You don't like people talking about.
Yeah.
Well,
that's true.
You even said today though. You said, so she tells some story about a family that had five kids, right?
Yeah.
Right, and the fifth kid was what was the problem?
Like a devil. I don't know.
A devil. Okay, the fifth kid was Satan. That's a problem. No, seriously, though, the fifth kid was what? Just really hard
to deal
with?
I don't know. I don't remember. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Destroyed the family, apparently. I don't remember.
And then you're like, you know, what if, I mean, you're pregnant.
Yeah, totally.
You're pregnant.
Yeah.
What if Satan is in your belly, right? And you're like, oh my God, what if Satan is in my belly?
Yeah.
I mean, my response to that, if Satan is in your belly and we're going to have Satan, I will crush his fucking spirit. You know what I mean? I'm not afraid of anybody.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely not afraid of like a problematic kid.
Yeah.
That's just not something to be scared of. If you want to be a wimp and be scared of that shit, then you can live your life. Not you, but one can do that. But I'm not afraid of Satan. Satan can step into my house and I'll make sure he knows who's the boss. But, you know, I think when you say you're getting tied up, what you mean is those scary ideas.
Yeah, they're scary. Yeah.
Scare you.
Yes.
Well, right. You start thinking, oh my God, is it going to happen to me? Is it going to happen
to me?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Right? That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's weird. Like, I'm just like, you know, it's not going to happen. And if it does, I'll deal with it.
Yeah.
And I brush it off.
Yeah.
What's the difference there?
Yeah.
What's the difference? Well, I mean, I think the difference is that I'm delusional and you're actually experiencing and relating to the possibility. Because mm-hmm. I just brush the possibility away. I'm just like, bleh. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, it's like, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And why would I fill between now and then mm-hmm. with unpleasant experiences and worrying? But it's also like, I'm not sure I'm choosing, because I don't think you're choosing to worry about whether you're going to give birth to Satan or not. Mm-hmm. I think you just really instinctually and constitutionally do.
Yeah,
and that's what you mean by getting wound up. Like you, really, you can't even brush it off.
Yeah, I can't keep. You can't shake the boundaries. Basically.
No, you can't keep those boundaries. Like,
even though basically everything she's said at that point, I'm like recognize that she's not someone I would ever want to spend a second with or ever want to talk to. It's still scary. And I mean, I think it reminds me of something I think we were talking about a couple episodes ago about like being okay with things you don't like being around kind of thing. Yeah. So I think there's something of that, but also I just think,
for liberals.
Yeah. Which is very hard for liberals. But I also think
because liberals can't in a sense close off the way you need to close off. So it's like, liberals are scared of ideas that they don't agree with because they don't, you know, they don't have like again, we're comparing your sensibility with my sensibility. Yeah. I can just brush stuff off and ignore it. You get really wrapped up in it.
Yeah.
Because I think you're a liberal. I mean, you're obviously a recovering liberal.
Yeah, yeah.
But you still have a lot of those liberal tendencies.
Yeah.
Then that's why liberals are really, really scared of stuff. But yet at the same time, interestingly enough, liberals mass produce horror story after horror story.
Yes, yes.
So what's up with that?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
I mean, I think they're so traumatized by their own imaginations that they literally spend their days and nights sitting in groups, either online or in person or in their home, sharing all these horror stories because they're so scared by them, and they think that if they share them and if they've like I mean you were referred this book by a liberal, a Northwest liberal, but worst kind, a good Lord, who found comfort in these horror stories.
She
they find they comfort in horror. What's
true.
Up with that? Like, I just find horror to be so silly and stupid.
Yeah.
Because I just look at the person sharing it and I'm like, why is this what you think about? Like, what kind of person are you that this is how you fill your days and fill your mind? I mean, there's so many amazing things to put in your mind, and you're putting this jaundiced dreck.
Right. Yeah.
So what's the other book?
Yeah. Well, wait, what? I think the last thing I want to say about this book is that it just reminded me of all the patterns that I have not gotten rid of. And that was like, I mean, I kind of know that, but also I don't know, like our son was listening to like the radio on his little Yodo, and they're like talking about, okay, so we're going to think about all the happy things and write them down and stuff. And I was just like, I mean, that's like banal enough. That should be fine. Right. But I'm also like, that's such a liberal thing to say that it like literally like, I'm not sure. I don't know. I was like, dude, is that something? I mean, he doesn't understand it yet, but like, it is like it feels like even stuff like that is like very liberal somehow. and I don't know if that's true or not, but there's just like all these ways that you're supposed to manage or deal with, or like, you know, deal with anxiety or deal with being a liberal, that I've just become very skeptical, partly because I don't feel like they've worked for me, but also just because they're, I feel like they're on the wrong, they're like the wrong direction, even though they're saying the right direction.
So the thing that you're talking about is there's something where they're like, let's write down happy thoughts. Is that what you're
yeah,
saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's gross.
Why is that gross?
I just am really tired of liberalism's kind of really pretentious religio-fascist propensity to push certain agendas and perspectives that it considers to be like the ones that are going to heal us and make us a better community.
Yeah.
It's just so like medieval.
Yeah.
And it's done under this banal benignity of blessed be, and like, oh, we're going to be so good, and it's going to be good, and we're finding the good in ourselves. And it's just very eugenical, and like, it's very social engineering-y, mm-hmm. I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's this all this stuff about how, like, oh, remember yeah. you mentioned your friend? No, it's not your friend. It's, what's her name? The Fox chick. Not Fox. Julia.
Oh, yeah. Julia Fox.
Julia Fox.
Yeah.
She's like a model actress kind of thing.
Yeah, she's like a total celebrity now.
Oh, she's a celebrity, sorry. And she was being interviewed and she's raising a boy and yeah. she's like, what did she say?
Yeah, she was talking about how she holds her son accountable for
all the crimes men have ever committed.
I mean, I don't know if she said exactly yeah, that way, but basically, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was pretty like, but she's always been a diehard liberal.
She's a woke mess.
Oh, she's always been, yeah.
Super woke mess. Yeah, so it's this real, like, you know, I'm going to shape people
yeah.
in the right way.
Yeah.
I'm going to exorcise their mm-hmm. darkness and make mm-hmm. them light. I'm going to teach them the difference between happy and sad and make sure they know what happy is and make mm-hmm. sure their sad is fully supported. Mm-hmm. And they better not hide their sad. They better yeah. not try to deal with their sad themselves. They better get that sad into the public square so we can all understand it and share it. And then we'll make a museum for it, you know?
Yeah.
It's just very programmatic. It's very extrovertedly manipulative and controlling and definitional and identitarian. And it's just like, you know, whatever happened to Dada, in a way, is what I want to yeah, say. Yeah. Like, where's the drugs? Where's the fun? Where's the freedom? Where's the weirdness?
Yeah.
Liberalism is so damn serious now.
Yeah.
And it's all out of a textbook, and it's all been studied at Harvard, and it's all been formulated, and it's all a giant curriculum, and it's all like, we're going to do this because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's like so conservative and narrow and bleh.
Yeah. I mean,
and it's so superficial, and it just comes across as so earnest. It's just so yeah. smarmy and maudlin and just in a sense like maliciously earnest, you
yeah.
know,
because yeah.
because
oh, yeah,
because
yeah.
its earnestness is really like, you know, I'm pushing these ideas on you because they're so absolutely right that if you don't think they're right, you're just an aberration.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you're evil.
Yeah.
I mean, I completely agree. I mean, I think part of the reason I've been wanting to read a book on mothering, because, you know,
You're a mother.
I'm a mother. And I've looked, I've tried to read, I've tried, you know, I've read many samples of many books. It's literally impossible to find a book. I mean, I haven't been able to find a single book that I feel like is a book I would recommend to anybody as a book on mothering, except for this other one that I just found, which I'm not sure, it's not really a book on mothering, but it's just kind of an interesting
Okay, so there's thing. Another book.
So yeah, there's another book I just started reading too, and it's called The Nurture Revolution. And it basically proposes that nurture parenting is what we should be doing, and talks about it very neuroscientifically in terms of the growth of a baby's brain. And the main idea is that a baby cannot self-soothe, that a baby doesn't even start to learn what self-soothing is. That brain capacity doesn't even exist until after, like, starts building, like, from ages three to 25. But that in that early time, the 0 to 3, basically the baby borrows the caregiver's soothing. So the baby will get upset, and then the caregiver is supposed to nurture or respond in, like, a, you're okay, you're safe, we're taking care of you, we're attending to the baby way. And I just thought it was really sweet. I don't know. I thought it was a very sweet way to think about what babies need, like when they're upset, what they're looking for.
So why did that not feel like
gross
liberalism?
Yeah. I mean, it probably is, frankly, you know, chances are it probably is, but I think that there were some things that felt somewhat true. Like they talk about how the mother's brain has also changed both during pregnancy and during especially that early time as well to kind of co-regulate. That's a big phrase with the baby to like be there for the baby.
I feel like you're responding positively to the book being a little more scientific.
Yeah, that's very true.
I mean, the other book sounds like a fictional memoir of a neurotic mess.
Yeah, that's very true.
And this one sounds like, you know,
it's supposedly scientific. Yeah. I find it a little hard to like fully trust it in that, like, I mean, to fully trust the idea that it's scientific, but it definitely presents this solid scientific argument that goes along with everything I've ever heard about, you know, how that this whole thing works.
Yeah, we know science is entirely liberal.
Yeah, I know. That's why I said I have a hard time fully believing it.
Yeah.
But,
it sounds like a lovely message too, because it's like, you know, nurture, like, what is it? It's soothe your child, love your child, care for your child, just comfort your child, be kind to your child, make your child feel safe. I like all that stuff. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess that's also it. It's just sort of generally positive. You're like, oh yeah, that's just sort of positive, and that's kind of nice. And that is, I mean, so in a way, it almost feels like a positive parenting book.
But I have to ask, why, what's? I mean, I'm sure there are people who might need that book.
Yeah.
We don't need that book.
Yeah.
There are probably people who do need that book, like to be reminded that they should be loving and nurturing and caring toward their children and comfort them.
Yeah.
But you don't need to be reminded of that. You're the most loving, nurturing, caring mother I've ever seen. So what do you?
I think.
What's the point?
I don't know. Again, I'm pretty early in it, so I'm still just kind of learning. But I think I find it interesting how they talk about the stress response and how. I don't know how supposedly this nurturing helps to get back to like a baseline as opposed to being in a heightened stress response, which I find happy. I mean, that's like kind of, but that's also just sort of positive thinking.
Yeah, it sounds to me like the book just has a little more sort of, again, like it's just a little more scientifically presented.
Yeah.
And the other book sounds completely unscientific.
I mean,
so
they're very different genres well.
And it sounds like you are enjoying getting some words for what you're observing, because you have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old.
Yeah.
Co-regulated and...
Yeah.
And
yeah. Totally.
I think it sounds like you were interested
in... I mean, it's actually something that my therapist has said to me, that like that's what I look for, is like co-regulation when I'm...
What is so define it.
So... I believe, like, if you think of a baby and a parent, like, a baby like screams and is upset, and then the parent comes over and is like holds the baby and calms the baby and just says everything's okay, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So like I also think that that's in a way what I look for.
That's co-regulate.
Yeah.
But how is that co-regulation?
I'm not sure. I might be using that word a little incorrectly.
Yeah.
Because that's more of like a comforting or nurturing response.
So you want to show the baby, you want to
be there for the baby, yeah, time again,
yeah,
and be like a solid, yeah,
yeah,
responder, I guess, a solid first responder.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. That's cool.
Which like just makes sense. Like you said, it all just kind of makes sense naturally as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Co-regulation is the process where a more emotionally regulated person provides support, coaching, and modeling to help another person manage their own feelings and behaviors, particularly in moments of stress. So co-regulation is actually you who are more regulated.
Right.
Helping someone else regulate themselves.
So yeah. You're well, that's what they say, that like the child is like the baby is borrowing like the parent's ability to regulate, essentially. Right. Because they don't have that capacity yet.
And what was your therapist's point?
That I see that like what comforts me is co-regulation.
Oh, when someone co-regulates you.
Yeah, like you or my therapist or somebody. Yeah. And so that kind
of... Well, and the book, the first book you mentioned, is not co-regulating you.
That's right, yeah.
Right? It's doing the opposite.
Yeah.
So yeah, you don't like being around people or being around anything, any movie or any piece of writing or any post or video or nothing that is not co-regulating you. Like you really gravitate toward co-regulators.
Yeah, I guess so. Which is like really hard to find because everything is like psycho-liberal. So there isn't much co-regulation.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people are really seeking co-regulators and there's maybe not a lot of co-regulators around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absence of co-regulators.
Yeah.
That would be a great way to bridge the political divide, as if like non-liberals could become the co-regulators and liberals could accept being co-regulated by them.
Right.
Because I feel like non-liberals are way more co-regulating.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously. But also, like, I don't know, there's something about form and content there, I guess. I mean, the co-regulator is form.
Mm-hmm.
And the content is the person that needs to be regulated. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I would say that it would be interesting to try to deconstruct and definalize the idea of the co-regulator and the in need of regulation. Like I get it, like I have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old in my house, you know, and they often need regulation, no doubt about it. I would also say, you know, I think, I mean, I provide a safe, comforting environment for my children. Mm-hmm. I'm into that. I think that's right. I don't have any argument with the idea that that's a good thing to provide them. But I also wonder if there are other things that we should be providing children. Mm.
Yeah.
And I don't mean unsafe and uncomforting. I don't just mean the opposite or like negating those things and going in that. But I think being safe and comforting for children is a mantra. Mm-hmm. It's an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
It's a liberal position that's first and foremost. But I wonder if there's other things too that, you know, I don't know. It's as sappy as like, you know, what about thrills? What about risk? What about
frustration?
What about comedy?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What about one-upmanship? What about a surprise?
Yeah, totally.
What about helping them find ways to, you know, I think there's something inherent in the idea of co-regulating people. I mean, first of all, regulating people is a pretty intense idea. Yeah. But I think there's an assumption in the co-regulation mandate that someone is out of control and in need of something that we can identify.
Yeah.
And so then we're going to deliver it like medicine to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that every moment of a little person's life is unique. Mm-hmm. And like stamping them with this kind of program of safe and comforting doesn't always take into account some of the interesting dynamics that are going on inside them.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. There's a lot of sort of, I enjoy being competitive with my children, mm-hmm. in a playful way. Mm-hmm. I enjoy being challenging. I enjoy being adventurous with them. I enjoy a lot of things that I think work on the periphery of safe. But I mean, safe and comforting needs to be the core.
Yeah.
But I think becoming too fixated on that can start to just kind of really...
Really be one-dimensional or something.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not... Like, they're going to have lots of experiences in life, and they're not going to all be like that. So they have to... Yeah. I mean, I think that my question to round out would be, why do liberal books still get to me like that, and how can I grow out of that?
I it's weird. I mean, I think you were not trained as a young person for like a good 2 decades from like 0 to meeting me.
To 25.
Yeah. To just dismiss things that are bullshit.
Yeah.
Like my mother obviously has gone crazy. She has dementia. She's really over the edge. But one thing that has become exacerbated in her personality is her kind of just like, and she's always, I realize she's always been like this, and she kind of raised us like this, which is that like she has a real ability to just kind of like call shit when it's shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she just bullshit with that. That's bullshit. Get that away from me. I don't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
She pushes it away and she cancels it out.
Mm-hmm.
I do that too, because I was trained to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You were not trained to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think there's a downside to what I was trained to do, and there's a downside to what you were trained to do. And how do we... So I think the deeper question is, how do we not do what we've always been trained to do?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm kind of tired of the, like, well, recognize the patterns of the liberals. And I'm just, like, tired of that whole, like, recognize the patterns, and then that'll help you somehow not repeat them. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think there's also just something really, bugging me about the whole, well, the traditional therapeutic messaging that just feels like...
I mean, I
feel like it goes somewhere for me.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I think ultimately, I mean, it's not a profound thing to say, but like, you got to find something else to do.
Yeah.
So I think, and you're like, you know, I don't know what that is,
mm-hmm.
but I think in the idea of finding something else to do, there's two things that are critical. One is fully abandoning
mm-hmm.
the therapeutic form
mm-hmm.
and fully accepting that it's not just about not embracing the therapeutic form, it's about really developing a new a new way of doing things. And I mean, I think Heidegger's example is really pertinent here, because it's not just about kind of like inventing a new therapy. Mm-hmm, it's right. not about escaping metaphysics by inventing another metaphysics. Mm-hmm. It's really saying, what is the trap that therapy is? Mm-hmm. And how can I get out of the trap and not step into another trap?
Yeah.
And what is that? And how can I? So, I mean, it's a little, you know, I don't know what it is. And I don't know. I think it's probably something that you need to be thinking about every day, mm-hmm. in a very granular way, morning, afternoon, and night, as you go about your business. Think where like you're digging for gold. Where can mm-hmm. I find a little something that makes me feel like I'm out of that trap? Mm-hmm. But it has to be active. It has to be a way of living, a way of thinking, a way of doing things. It has mm-hmm. to be very get up and go, make things happen kind of active stuff.
Yeah.
I think that the books you read are important.
Yeah.
I think you need to stop taking book suggestions from your woke witches, because yeah. they're just going to continue to just ingrain.
There are no non-woke books, are there?
Yeah, we're reading one right here.
Yes.
Is this the only one?
I don't know, is it?
I don't know. Let's start a non-woke book club.
Okay.
You know, let's find another non-woke book.
Yeah.
Go looking for non-woke books. I don't know. You know, look for non-woke books. Anyhow, I'm not sure I provided anything, but I hear you. I think your frustration is warranted. It's tough. Yeah. I mean, are there non-woke books? Are you kidding me? It's super hard to find. Try to find a non-woke movie. I mean, it's just like, I mean, we haven't been to movies in two decades because there are no non-woke movies.
Yeah, that's true.
As soon as you really see what liberalism is, the possibilities of truth and genuine experience become so few that you almost have to just dedicate your life to like looking for them mm-hmm. or creating them. Yeah. How about that?
Yeah.
You're an artist.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you have to write a non-woke book.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't answer the question, did I?
That's okay.
We're working on the answer, aren't we?
Yes.
With every episode.
Yeah.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.